Ukraine and the IAEA say that they've learned of a serious development at the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant.
We actually also hear the news about a blackout in the city of Enerhodar, but not only in the city of Enerhodar, but also in general in Zaporizhia region.
Plus, the challenges facing the European Union as energy ministers meet to discuss a potential price cap on Russian exports.
In order for that to work, you have to make sure that they can't get higher prices from selling to other markets. And thus far, India, China, and other countries have actually been willing to continue.
And later in the program, how everyday Ukrainians are crowdfunding significant military purchases. Today is Friday, September 9th. From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Ukraine. Good evening. I'm Steve Miller. Ukrainian officials, as well as the Director General of the International Atomic Energy Agency, say that the situation around the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant has deteriorated to an alarming level. Anna Chernikova in Kyiv joins us with more.
We actually also hear the news about a blackout in the city of Enerhodar, but not only in the city of Enerhodar, but also in general in the Zaporizhia region. And a lot of settlements and cities are affected. The main explosion that caused this blackout happened back on September 6th. For the moment, the city of Enerhodar, as well as other cities in the region, remain with a big problem in terms of electricity supply and water supply. Also, shelling continues, so we do have information that the region remains under the shelling, and of course this creates additional danger, especially for the nuclear power plant. What we hear from the locals and from also local media is that actually people are quite concerned, even very concerned, of course. Of course, this situation, again, I would just repeat what Ukrainian government have already said. This situation requires immediate demilitarization of the zone and creation of a special safe area around the nuclear power plant. And this is also what Mr. Grossi highlighted once again.
And on that note, Director Grossi in his statement also said that the situation is completely unacceptable and unsustainable and is becoming increasingly precarious. Switching gears just slightly, I wanted to focus in the time we have left on the reports that Ukrainian forces are continuing to quickly advance in their counteroffensive measures. What can you share with us on this Friday?
President Zelensky, in his latest announcement, said that since September 1st, Ukrainian armed forces have liberated more than 1,000 square kilometers of the territory of Ukraine that was occupied by the Russian forces. Also today, in the latest Institute for the Study of War report, it was mentioned that Ukrainian forces will likely to capture the city of Kupiansk in the next 3 days, 72 hours. The Institute for the Study of War sees this as a very likely action that might happen, which would mean that Ukrainian forces will very badly damage the communication lines and supply lines of the Russian forces around the territory of Izum and the city of Izum itself.
Anna Chernikova in Kyiv. And we'll be hearing again from Anna later in the program. Be sure to visit voanews.com/flashpoint for additional updates on the war 24 hours a day. European Union energy ministers were split on Friday over whether to cap Russian gas prices. They had hoped to reach an agreement as they met to work out steps to shield citizens and businesses from sky-high energy bills and prevent power utilities from collapsing, as Russia has gradually turned off gas supplies to Europe in the standoff over Ukraine. Russian President Vladimir Putin threatened to sever supplies on Wednesday if such limits were imposed. Friday's ministerial talks aimed to whittle down options to those with broad support before presenting formal proposals rather than reaching a final decision. Emily Holland at the U.S. Naval War College tells VOA there's more to addressing the price issue than just implementing a price cap.
The sort of point of an oil cap or a price cap in general is to keep prices low, but elevated enough to protect Russia's production costs so that they would still have an incentive to sell it even at a lower price. But in order for that to work, you have to make sure that they can't get higher prices from selling to other markets. And thus far, India, China, and other countries have actually been willing to continue buying Russian energy prices. And so the price caps might not be as effective as the planners envision it.
Kathleen Hancock, associate political science professor at the Colorado School of Mines, says that should Putin carry through on his threat to cut off natural gas supplies, it may not mean a large reduction in the amount currently supplied to Europe.
According to the European Union officials, that Russian natural gas now makes up only 9% of EU gas imports. That is down from 40%. So that's quite astonishing and an incredible move. It does suggest that cutting further from 9 to 0, that doesn't seem so far, but they have, of course, cut way, way back already. So that last 9% could be extremely painful.
As noted earlier, there is division within the EU as to whether or not to enact a price cap. And previous calls for complete bans have met opposition, something Holland says could be problematic.
The EU is divided, then they are not going to be able to deter Russia or to alleviate some of the pressures on other states that want to reduce their consumption of Russian energy. And that's already leading to serious problems in the European economy. You know, industrial production, energy intensive industries is considerably down. This is going to have major knock-on effects.
Something she says could manifest over the next few years. You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. I'm Steve Miller. Eli Rosenbaum has been with the U.S. Department of Justice for more than 35 years, and for decades, he's been hunting Nazi war criminals. He's currently serving as the Director of Human Rights Enforcement Strategy and Policy at the DOJ. Christian Levesque serves as the top prosecutor for the DOJ's War Crimes Accountability Team. Both have previously appeared on this program, and they recently also sat down with VOA Ukrainian service reporter Oleksiy Kovalenk. The conversation began by Rosenbaum explaining what lessons he's learned from the investigation of Nazi war crimes and how applicable they are to his current investigation of Russian war crimes.
The lessons that we learned from investigating and prosecuting World War II Nazi perpetrators who came to this country are numerous. World War II Nazi cases and these, fundamentally, it's the same issue, wartime crimes and who perpetrated them and how do you prove it. A difference, an unhappy difference, shall we say, in the World War II cases, Nazi Germany was succeeded by a responsible German government that has prosecuted its own people for participation in Nazi crimes. As you might imagine, there's no expectation of getting cooperation from the Russian Federation authorities anytime soon. In this instance, the war is, of course, still on. The tragedy continues. The crimes are still being committed. And that makes these cases, certainly for me and most of my colleagues, I would say, the most urgent ones that we've ever encountered, because the crimes are still being perpetrated and there is a heightened need to send the message out to would-be perpetrators that the United States is partnered with the government of Ukraine, with the Ukrainian Prosecutor General's Office in particular, with the National Police of Ukraine, and with authorities all over Europe to investigate and prosecute these cases. So if you dare execute, say, a criminal order, you will never, ever be able to be confident that you've gotten away with it. You will have to look over your shoulder for the rest of your life into old age, just the way Nazi perpetrators have had to do.
As someone who investigated multiple Nazi war crimes and now is looking into cases of Russian war crimes in Ukraine, what would you say to Putin's message about denazifying Ukraine?
After actually 37 or so years investigating and prosecuting World War II Nazi cases, I think I can say that I know a Nazi when I see one. The Ukrainian government is not a Nazi government. Two countries in living memory have invaded Ukraine without provocation: Nazi Germany and the Russian Federation. So who's channeling the Hitler regime? It's not the government in Kyiv.
Russian forces committed multiple crimes in Ukraine, and many of them are very well documented, documented in live mode, such as bombing of houses, crushed theater in Mariupol, extrajudicial killings, executions, including prisoners of war. Could you shed light on the current cooperation with Ukrainian authorities and International Criminal Court investigators on investigating those crimes?
Sure. There are probably two aspects that I should focus on. One is enforcement of our own laws here. And that, too, has, you could argue, two components. One is the task force kleptocapture, which Attorney General Merrick Garland announced in March, which is pursuing, among others, the facilitators of aggression by the Russian Federation. Most of your viewers have probably seen the news photos of super yachts that our government has confiscated from oligarchs who are supporting the Putin government. And then there are also our own investigations of war crimes. That effort is led by my colleague here, Christian Levesque, who is lead prosecutor for the Ukraine cases. There is the International Criminal Investigative Training Assistance Program, ISATAP, that works very closely with the National Police of Ukraine. They've done that for years. They are now pivoting to support war crimes investigations in the field, so to speak. There is forensic support. There is all kinds of technical support, including IT support and some things I can't go into. But it's a very, very close relationship. And we actually met with the Office of the Prosecutor General of Ukraine just yesterday. So we're very busy in that cooperative effort.
And in terms of the U.S. investigations and prosecutions, you mentioned that really on almost a daily basis, we're all bombarded with stories of atrocities that are occurring in Ukraine. It's the job of prosecutors and investigators to work together, both domestically, but also with our international counterparts, to sift through that information, to methodically assess it. We are trying to do this in another country during a time when there's an active armed conflict. But we're doing all of those things collectively.
I understand that it's difficult to talk about the ongoing investigation, but could you tell the common details on what cases you are investigating?
So unfortunately, I can't talk about specific investigations. What I can say, as the Attorney General has also stated publicly, is that where the U.S. has jurisdiction under our War Crimes Act, that is when a U.S. Citizen is a victim or a perpetrator of a war crime, it is our duty, as well as our, you know, to exercise our due diligence and to investigate those circumstances to determine whether a war crime that is actionable under our statute has occurred. The reason that we don't speak publicly about investigations is because this is really a central tenet of that concept of the rule of law, which is that we are going through our processes without interruption, without bias, and without outside influence. And in order to do that, that means that we conduct our investigations in a manner that is not public.
And more on cooperation. There are a lot of international bodies that you already mentioned. There are a lot of organizations that are tracking down war crimes that are committed in Ukraine. And UN Human Rights Council established independent commission of inquiry. Given the massive scale of crimes being committed in Ukraine right now, what do you think would be the best forum for prosecutions?
So I think that there is no one answer in terms of what is the best forum for prosecutions. And that's one of the things also that is particularly remarkable about what we are seeing right now in Ukraine and in this time and place, which is Ukraine itself, as a national authority, has a well-functioning legal system with capacity and ability to actually investigate the crimes that are occurring on their soil. And so it is a very important part of accountability measures that they continue to do so. It's also a responsibility of the international community, and that is other national authorities, the United States, and international organizations to assist and support in that process, and also to play their own role. And one of the roles that we're playing in the United States is when we have U.S. jurisdiction, we are also doing our own investigations.
You mentioned yourself that there is massive evidence and massive proof of war crimes committed in Ukraine, and that is very different from your work on investigating and looking into Nazi war crimes, where there might be not so much proof and records available online. You've seen footage from Olenivka, barbaric videos of torturing and killing prisoners of war, including Putin. Parts of the body of Ukrainian prisoner of war on the fence in Popasna. The amount of visual proof is sometimes overwhelming, and including from accounts of Russian soldiers themselves in social media. Is that helping investigation?
All of these kinds of images and intercepted communications can be important evidence. Again, this is the kind of evidence that usually one didn't have in the World War II Nazi cases. But sometimes, you know, you don't need all that much evidence. I have in mind the last Nazi, World War II Nazi case that we won only 2 years ago. The defendant was in his 90s. And that case began with a waterlogged SS personnel card pulled from Lübeck Bay, Germany in 1950. It was only partially legible, but it had our man's name on it. And he worked as a guard at a concentration camp from which virtually no records survived. But we have the talent, the experience to build cases from a very small sample of evidence, and we're deploying those skills in partnership with the FBI, Homeland Security Investigations in the Department of Homeland Security, lots of components of the Justice Department, and of course we work alongside the Department of State.
Could you walk us through the process of identifying whether one or another crime committed in Ukraine is a war crime or crime against humanity?
Sure. So we would start first with looking at whether we have jurisdiction. And as I've already mentioned, it's fairly limited. Then we would start to look at the circumstances, right? In this case, we know that there is an armed conflict and an international armed conflict that's occurring in Ukraine. Then we would look at what is the nature of the actual conduct and does it fit within our statute? Does it appear to be an intentional killing of a civilian who is not participating in hostilities? Does it appear to be the intentional infliction of unnecessary suffering on a person who is protected? Does it appear to be an unlawful confinement of a protected person? Or does it fall in some other way within our war crime statute? So we literally take out our statute book, we look at it, we look at what the conduct is and the facts and the allegations and see if we have a match.
Mr. Rosenbaum, you mentioned to yourselves that there is a difference between post-war Germany and Russia, that Russia will not be probably willing to cooperate unless there is a change of government. Is there a procedure to deliver justice for the victims of war crimes of Russian soldiers in case if they are not leaving the country, in case if there is no extradition without cooperation of Russian authorities?
Well, most likely this is going to have to be accomplished without cooperation from Russian authorities unless, as you say, there is a change of government and a change of attitude. And who knows what the future holds. There are various mechanisms, including, frankly, civil liability that will help secure some measure of justice even outside the criminal justice system. And it's going to be a lot of different courts in many different countries and a lot of different organizations, governmental, intergovernmental, and non-governmental, that will all be working together, are already working together, to pursue justice on behalf of the victims. And that includes providing services to surviving victims who are dealing with physical and psychological impacts of what they've experienced.
That was Eli Rosenbaum, the director of the Human Rights Enforcement Strategy and Policy at the U.S. Justice Department, as well as his colleague, Kristen Levesque, the DOJ's top prosecutor on the War Crimes Accountability Team. They were speaking to Oleski Kovalenk from VOA's Ukrainian service. And as promised, Anna Chernikova is back to round us out this week with a story about Ukrainians of different ages, incomes, and military experience all coming together to donate money to provide the Ukrainian army with weapons, including a satellite.
Ukrainians in Kyiv view an exposition of destroyed Russian military equipment, another scene of solidarity since Russia began its full-scale invasion of the country. Ordinary Ukrainians have poured out massive support through humanitarian and charity drives. Now, in the latest national fundraising effort, Ukrainians have raised money to buy a satellite for their army. In June 2022, a charity foundation started by Serhii Pritula, a famous TV personality, announced what it said was the biggest fundraising campaign in Ukrainian history. The goal? To collect $16 million to buy three Turkish-made Bayraktar drones for the Ukrainian army. Ukrainians managed to collect the full amount in fewer than 3 days. Children, seniors, and businesses participated in the campaign. Executives at the Turkish defense company Baykar were so touched by the display of solidarity, they decided to give the drones to Ukraine for free. In a statement, company officials said, Baykar will not accept payment for the TB2s and will send three UAVs free of charge to the Ukrainian war front. We ask that raised funds be remitted instead to the struggling people of Ukraine. The money was then earmarked for the purchase of much-needed satellite for Ukraine's army intelligence. Ukrainian officials are now preparing to close a deal to purchase a satellite already in orbit from its Finnish owners.
In this case, it's not only about drones or about satellite, it's about unity, about our needs. We just want to live like a nation, like a state, and that's why it's really cool that all society was united by this case. Little kids, old people, celebrity stars, business, and all donate for this project. And after that, that was possibility to buy this satellite.
Two of the donors include 11-year-old Serhii and 10-year-old David. The two friends picked cherries in Serhii's grandparents' garden and sold them to collect money for the cause.
We went to pick cherries. Our parents suggested the idea to sell cherries, and we agreed because we need to help Ukraine. We need to help our armed forces.
We are not adults yet, but we are already helping the army, and we know that when we are older, we will help them in the same way.
The so-called People's Satellite will be owned by the Ukrainian state as the nation continues to unite against Russia's war. Anna Chernikova for VOA News, Kyiv.
And that's going to do it for us this week. Be sure to stay up to date with our continuing coverage, not only on Ukraine, but on news and events from around the world. You can do so 24 hours a day by pointing your web browser to voanews.com on your mobile phone, your desktop computer, or any other electronic device. You can also get additional information by following us on social media, Twitter, Instagram, Facebook. Just look for VOA News. On behalf of the entire Flashpoint Ukraine team, thank you for listening. Until next time, I'm VOA's Steve Miller. Be well, be safe, and good night.
This is the voice of America. Washington, D.C.